Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Since it's Tuesday, we must have, it must be Belgium and Hugh Hallman and Lewis Hallman. Hugh Hallman, former mayor of Tempe, attorney in town, philanthropist, and other things. Welcome back from Kazakhstan. Lewis Hallman, welcome back from western parts of Arizona.
Glad to be here.
And it's good to see you, Brother 3, Marcus. Brother 3, because it's the other two have been here before.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, nice to see you.
He would also be the youngest but the tallest.
Yeah.
And he would tell you the best looking.
Yeah. All right.
There you go.
It's nice. I hope you had a good trip. It's nice to
see you. It was exhausting. I am still a little jet lagged and feeling a little upside down. I was exactly 12 hours off by time zone, and so it is truly being upside down.
Well, we'll try not to exploit your exhaustion for the point of the conversation today, where I know you and I have a few disagreements. But let me do a quick shout out to Sarah and Natalie, devoted listeners. That having been said, let's get to it.
Sarah and Natalie, two fine names.
Yeah, good names. I was talking a little bit about kind of some interesting razor's edges with regard to political criticism of America. And Joe Scarborough, in a, what I would consider a screed last night about how it is the Donald Trump candidacy and the MAGA movement that is responsible for running America down rhetorically, verbally. And I thought, when did you wake up, is what I thought, given the whole history and trajectory of the left usually running America down. And there's a lot to do with it and about it. And I know we have we come at it from slightly different angles. So I'll let either of you open up wherever either of you would like to open up.
Well, I think you criticized me for saying that the screed was had merit to it. And if you just remove the criticism of the MAGA piece and say that it's MAGA saying this, and instead just focus on the data he was using to defend how the position of the United States relative to the rest of the world, and that it is, although we have problems, it is still the country that hits top marks in almost every way. After our conversation and your criticism that I failed to note that, you know, he was really trying to attack Republicans and conservatives and Donald Trump in particular for saying nasty things about the United States, I did say, and I still agree, that it is a program, or pogrom, if you prefer, that's followed by both parties, depending on who's in office and who's seeking office. And so when you're hearing the dismantling of America these days from the right, it's because folks are trying to remove Joseph Biden and Democrats from the Senate and House. And Republicans are defending their positions about how well they've done in the past. So you've got I'm not going to argue with you about that. I think Joseph Biden is doing a miserable job. We have in the last 3 years entered into terribly dangerous territory across the globe, in large part because, as you discussed in your monologue yesterday, America is no longer standing up for its principles. And where a Ronald Reagan would have responded with some force against those who use force, we've had turning a blind eye or turning a cheek. And we're getting slapped pretty hard on both sides. And I think that's not helping us. But you and I also agree that the New York Times piece that was titled "Democrats Need to Stop Playing Nice," which ran back in March 11th, 2024, by Joe Klein, was laughable because he's raising all kinds of points about how Democrats are so nice and Republicans are so evil. And I just don't remember a Republican calling half the country deplorables.
Or telling them that the presidential candidate wants to put black people in chains, let us say.
Yeah, let us say. Or saying that the president who was elected in 2004 or 2008, the 2004 election, was illegitimate.
Right, right. So, go ahead. Thank you for that.
I'm not sure entirely that issues like this are really worth taking up a terrible amount of conversation. What we have is classic, you know, electoral gamesmanship, really, is what we have. And we have everyone on the left is saying, because they're the incumbents, no, we're doing a great job, steady the course. And everyone on the right is now of the position that we need to tear down the current administration. And so that necessitates a criticism of current U.S. policy. If we go back to the 2020 election when Trump was the incumbent and the Republicans were the administration, then we saw the Democrats beating up on what had been the official government policy of the last 4 years. So this is the type of thing that will switch around very often. And rather than let ourselves get caught up by obvious rage bait from pundits that are speaking more to placate their partisan base than they are to elucidate or to bring any kind of insight, I think instead we're better served letting the silly clown make his noises, laugh at him, acknowledge him, ignore him, but then move on and go about the serious business of actually having the conversation.
So let's start the conversation, because the substance of what he was saying, that Scarborough was saying about the U.S.'s position in the world, I think merits discussion. The two main points he's making are the U.S. military might and the U.S. economic might. And on those two fronts, it is still unchallenged that the United States, at 333 million people, has an economy that is running in the
north of 20 trillion.
Well, it's farther north than 20 trillion. I think the current number is
25?
$26 trillion, while China, with 1.4 billion people or plus minus,
it's got to be about 18 or 19.
Is 18 and a half. So, now, it has grown dramatically in the last 30 years, but that is always going to be the case, that they're going to be losers and winners as the economies churn. We have heard for decades from the left, oh, you know, we're such a terrible place, and instead look at Sweden. Oh, we're such a terrible place, look at Japan. And it's always going to be the case that you can find a better indicator in a country on a specific metric for a few years.
Particularly ones that are so homogeneous.
Let me preempt one piece, though, just on that. With the Chinese economy, one statistic that you will see to make the case that China has a larger economy than the U.S. is the GDP per capita adjusted by what's called purchasing power parity.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do this calculation to adjust for the fact that if you buy a Big Mac in the U.S., it costs you $4.75, but if you buy a Big Mac in Shanghai, it costs you, you know, $2.25 or so, things are cheaper in China, so the single dollar goes farther.
Understood.
And so in consequence, they're lower GDP per capita goes a bit further than it would. That's also how Russia is able to do quite a lot on what appears to be a shoestring GDP per capita of about, what are they at, $8,000 ahead,
yeah,
something like that?
More or less.
As a middle-income country, but yet nonetheless are able to, you know, deploy troops en masse and engage in weapons development, keep their nuclear arsenal in check. All of this is because purchasing power parity is helping these these less industrialized militaries.
Certainly, but now let's add one thing that inflates, for example, China's economy. And I believe, Lewis, you're the expert on this number. How many excess household buildings does China currently have?
Well, so China is
That number, Lou.
So let me give the context around that number, if you don't mind. So in the entire rest of the world, except for China, if you count the number of empty houses, right, houses where someone could move in, you get about room for 300 million people, give or take.
So there's 300
million empty units.
Empty available units.
In all of the world except for China. If you just look at the Chinese number, you get up to about 1.5 billion empty units, or five times as much as the rest of the world combined. China has been using the lion's share of the global concrete supply over the last 30 years as they look to construct, build infrastructure, grow their economy.
And I'm going to stop you there. My point would be every one of those empty units counted as an expenditure and an addition to their GDP as it was being built. The same issue is going on in the Soviet Union, that you can take diamonds, which are very expensive, and smash them into dust is a very expensive thing, but it actually reduces value, though it is counted in the opposite direction. Just as building excess housing units that are useless to your society counts towards your GDP, it actually is value reducing.
So this would be sort of the difference between GDP, which is the total economic value generated by the activity of a society, and the wealth of a society, which is the value of all of its capital assets. So if you think about it this way, China's construction boom has been creating GDP figures, but has been squandering the wealth of that country.
Let me pick up on this and have a little bit of a retort, if I can, on the other side of this break. My guests...
No.
If I can, let me. I did ask. My guests are Hugh Hallman and Lewis Hallman, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Hugh Hallman and Lewis Hallman are my guests. I did not mention Lewis Hallman's identification, which I meant to. He is the managing director of Insight Analytics, LLC, Insight, I-N-C-I-T-E. In talking about the criticism of America from within America and from within the political party and campaign season. let me concede a point that I don't think would be countermanded by anyone who calls themselves part of the MAGA movement. I don't think anyone part of the MAGA movement or today's Republican Party or any overlap therein would say that there are other countries that are better than us generally. I don't think we're making the case that America sucks in relationship to other countries. I think what we're saying is by comparison to where we should be and where we have been, we're doing really poorly. And for example, in 1979, our chief competitor would have certainly been the Soviet Union, perhaps another country, but maybe Japan in a few years after that. No one would have thought they were better than us. They would have thought they were great threats to us. But in the 1977, 78, 79 years, I think it would be very common for people to say, God, it sucks in America.
And you're not going to get a disagreement from me, and I believe I said that. That is,
which is, by the way, oh, sorry, let me put a coda on that point. Sorry, coda to that point. Sorry. Which is why the Reagan-Bush campaign theme of 1980 was, surprise, surprise, make America great again.
Well, more or less.
Well, no, it was.
More or less. And it was to talk about American greatness and exceptionalism and how we need to build on that. And that is, I think, the flaw of the current Republican and conservative movement is to fail to do the Reagan-esque piece, which is to say, we can do better. We are a great country, but we can do better. And we have spent the last 4 years under Jimmy Carter foundering, and we are not where we could have been. And that's exactly what I think the argument should be now, is that America is a great country. We have a great people here, but we also can easily squander it.
But that wasn't running down the country.
I didn't say it was.
No, but Joe Scarborough says that today, that
because there are no, he is saying that there are people who say America sucks. And I find
tactically, kinetically, not theoretically, not philosophically. The left says America sucks theoretically and philosophically. I think what the MAGA movement, the Republicans, are saying is things stink around here right now, whether we're talking economy, whether we're talking infrastructure, whether we're talking deaths of despair, whether we're talking education, whether we're talking any number of indicia. And it's not just Republicans who say that. Joe Biden is underwater on every one of these things.
I agree. But that is a difference between saying America sucks and saying that we are a great country, but we are foundering currently because the leadership we are under is not taking advantage of our great attributes.
You think,
and instead, we're squandering our security with a failed border policy. We have squandered our position in the world by failing to take on China directly about its theft of intellectual property and its attack threatening Taiwan. We have failed the Middle East by allowing Hamas to do what it did on October 7th. We have failed to secure Europe because we allowed Vladimir Putin to roll into Crimea. And then that was under Barack Obama, and then under his handmaiden, his understudy, to roll into Ukraine proper. All of those things are true. All of that wealth of our society has been squandered by bad leadership. You're not going to get that argument from me, but that doesn't make America bad. It makes our current leadership terrible, and that the American people are recognizing that the failure of the policies that have been implemented by the Biden administration have failed us all.
But a movement that says they want to make America great again inherently and endemically is not saying America is a bad place or a sucky place. They're not running America down. They're saying they want to make America good like it used to be.
I don't think you're hearing any disagreement from either me or Dad on that one.
Okay, so I don't think they're running down America.
So
the way Joe Scarborough is saying they are running down America.
I don't think that they are
the
either.
Province of the leftist rhetoric.
I think we are talking roundly about one another and ultimately agreeing on the point that you know the criticism is on the policy, less the concept.
Well, that makes this a very short segment.
No, it what it means is then let's go back to the indicators of America's greatness and its exceptionalism.
Okay.
Are there concerns? Yes. I think every other show I end the show talking about that it is easy to squander the legacy that we've inherited. It is very easy because the principles and the policy and the philosophy they uphold this, if we do not pass it on to our children, it will be lost. This liberal in the classical sense concept does not pass, as Ronald Reagan explained, it through the bloodstream.
Right.
We must educate people about it. Right. And when you have as many young people who believe that socialism and communism are a better standard by which one can live than a capitalistic-based society, you've got a problem.
Yeah.
When you have people who think that Marxism is a philosophy that should be taught and understood and practiced, you've got a problem. People who do not understand the Federalist Papers, do not understand the Declaration of Independence as the founding of this country, and instead say 1619 is the founding mark of this country, are fools, in my view. And we have failed to pass that on. That said, most of the people still out on the street understand the principles and the philosophy. There's a reason when leftist crazies try to take over baseball and turn it into some kind of pageant for leftist causes, they lose. Right? The people sitting in baseball stadiums and football stadiums who are average Americans who understand the basis of this society are the ones who said taking a knee during the national anthem is not the right thing to
do. They lose? I don't know if they lost. The NFL didn't back down on this stuff. The LA Dodgers didn't back down on this stuff.
Where is Colin Kaepernick? I don't remember him playing.
Making millions and millions and millions of dollars is where he is.
So not playing.
Well, yeah, but he wasn't playing before he started his rants against America either.
So to get back to your short segment, then let's look at military prowess. The fact is,
we have two national anthems at the Super Bowl, Hugh.
Only one of them was televised.
Okay. All right. Well,
that tells you everything you really needed to know, didn't you?
Let's not suffer from the bigotry of
That is the point. Only one of them was televised because even the NFL knew it did not want to pick that fight.
All right.
But military prowess.
Yeah, military prowess.
The success that occurred when Iran, as has been discussed, opened its first direct flights from Tehran to Israel since 1979, lost miserably. That 98-99% of their massive weapons barrage sent to Israel failed. That demonstrates a technological advantage that the U.S. still possesses.
Sure. And we had technological advances in 1979, too, but it sucked. We sucked. We were not doing well in 1979 here, and the fact that some other places were failing worse was not really the greatest aspiration for us, was it?
I don't think it is either.
Okay. All right.
But I'm not making that argument.
No, but Joe Scarborough
You're trying
is.
To say that
but
I
Joe
am.
Scarborough is. He says we are stronger than the rest of the world while the right is full of hate America first rhetoric. And I dispute that that's true. I think the left is full of hate America first rhetoric.
I agree with that second point, except that we have too many people on the right who also are spewing hate America because they say America sucks, not we can do better.
Okay. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Hugh Hallman, Lewis Hallman, my guest. Lewis, let me put this directly to you. This is right in your wheelhouse based on a similar conversation I was having with a friend of mine this morning, California. Hugh knows him. And he was saying he gets the sense, and I was summarizing kind of the discussion that Hugh and I had over this morning. He said it's his sense that, you know, the history of the world is obviously written replete with empires, countries that at points bestride their continent or the world, and they ultimately start failing and falling. And they had their day, and they go into decline. He says that may be true about America right now. We may be going into decline right now. And whether that's a pessimistic view and a surrendering view, or whether it's a realistic view where you want to grab it and turn around and be the progressive who realizes he's on the wrong road and turns around first, to borrow from C.S. Lewis. Or maybe it's just entirely inaccurate. But I thought, well, that's a point for Lewis to think through.
It makes me think about the writings of a historian from the early part of the 20th century who I think has since fallen out of favor a little bit. But the guy's name is Peter Turchin.
Oh, okay.
And he talks about cycles of history.
Yeah.
And one of the things that he talks about is a notion that it is very difficult for societies and civilization and empire to endure past about 10 generations. And you can look through human history.
Ish.
About 300, 250 to 300 years, give or take. And, you know, you could look at the Portuguese Empire, the Spanish Empire, the British Empire, the Roman Republic, and then later the Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire. You could see the Ottomans, and all of them are really contained within this time frame. Examples of societies that contiguously run longer than 10 generations are rare. You know, we could look at Chinese history, but even there, Chinese history is less a contiguous run and more a series of every 5 to 10 generations of empires exploding and then interceding warlordism.
All right.
And so, as I count, you know, 1776 to 2024,
up against it.
That's right about 250 years. Yeah. And so, you know, there might be a source of dread there, and there may be some meat there. You know, I'm not sure I buy 100% that there's something,
about
10 generations.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, one could theorize that 300 years might be the time it takes for the founding stories and myths of a society, right, the rationale for why we do what we do, to sort of become denuded by new ideas, new phases, new demography, things like that.
And do you see indicia that points in that direction as a warning right now? Or do you think it's overstated here in America? And I'll throw the same question to your dad in a sec.
I think that we would do well to pay attention to that idea, and that as Republicans, we are missing an enormous opportunity to run what is effectively a Bismarck-style play and come up with, redefine what we want America to mean, what we want it to be. And rather than waiting for the left to do it, a smart, dynamic candidate could put together a position to outflank the left and move the Republican Party forward in a way that is renewing but keeping a lot of the core values and identity and policy desires that it wants. But I don't think that anyone is thinking in those terms on the right or is willing to engage in that kind of conversation yet.
Well, I certainly had that conversation with somebody this morning about the fact that we should be looking for that kind of dynamic candidate that reminds us of a Ronald Reagan, who understood the philosophy, articulated it very well, and that articulation resonated in a large percentage of the population. Republicans and Democrats. That's why we had Reagan Democrats, and that it was his call back to the bases of this country's founding and the philosophy that gave rise to it that moved things forward.
It was also. And it was also an appeal to a common sense with a down market economy and an assault on, in that time period, what a lot of the working class Catholics were feeling with regard to education and with regard to their social values. Can I pick up on that? But also on the other side of the break, Hugh, before we actually exploit that further, because I know that that strums all of our hearts, the point Lewis made, just your analysis as to whether we're on the decline right now, generally, if we're heading toward a 300 mark, even if it's asymptotic. That's a good word to end the segment on. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Hugh Hallman and Lewis Hallman are my guests. Hugh's the former mayor of Tempe and an attorney in town, among many other things. Lewis Hallman is a guest host of this radio show, for one thing, but he's also the managing director of Insight Analytics. Hugh, we'll come back to the political point in a moment because it's a rich mine for all of us on the aspirational representation of the Republican Party. But first, condition of the country. Is it pointing towards a 300-year-ish decline, dispute over the definition of asymptotic, even if we never actually fail? Wouldn't that be the right use, Marcus? That would be the right use. The conditions of America are not good. And the trend lines, I think, are not pointing north.
Well, I think you certainly have pointed out in your monologue that we have data demonstrating a decline that's important to pay attention to. You have young people who are less well-educated about the founding principles of this country, who believe that Marxism is a fine philosophy, who are more anxious and suicidal, that we have the destruction of family formation in a way that you have for minority communities, upwards of 70%
sure.
of children born in right. single-parent households,
right.
typically led by mothers,
yep.
that you have now upwards of 40% of classic white households now in the same condition,
yep.
and people are pretending that that's a good thing.
Yep. Lower marriage rate, lower church rate.
All the kinds of things that create the de Tocqueville
right.
System that enhances and sustains a society. And the loss of that social fabric, where each one of us was a thread in that fabric and we're watching those threads get snapped. As a result, am I concerned? Absolutely I'm concerned. I'm an educator, for Pete's sake, and it was just a week ago that my son talked about the great education he got at Tempe Preparatory Academy, where he had to learn chemistry and physics and calculus and a foreign language and art and music and everything else. And the answer I would give you is that our educational system is failing our youth because we continue to dumb it down. And the right answer is every child should be exposed to those subjects. We should not be dumbing it down for anybody. And every child should be challenged to achieve the best they can achieve. And not everybody's going to be an A student, nor should we expect that. But if we challenge our students and expose them to critical thinking skills and provide them with opportunities to learn ancient and modern philosophy, they can then pick and choose and understand what has led us to this point in this moment in time where the United States still stands at the top of the mountain. There are reasons for that. Now, equally, I would say people can look at the United States and say, well, look at the number of homeless people you have. Look at the number of drug and alcohol addicts you have wandering your streets. And I realize my answer would be this. It is true, there are not that many in totalitarian regimes. But it is precisely one of the prices we pay for liberty and freedom is that some people get to choose that lifestyle. And the rest of us should figure out, and I'm sorry that we had 40 years ago judicial decisions that said that we do not as a society have the right to impose any kinds of restrictions on that behavior. I think we do. Because the loss of humanity in those people is horrific, and it's because we are failing to try to control bad behaviors, and we are enabling bad behavior. But the reality is, yes, it's true, we have more homeless people than they have in China, but we have the right to do all kinds of things that you can't do in China, including leave our apartments during COVID.
Or be a Muslim in the Xinjiang province, to be sure on all of that. But one last data point, and Lewis, then you can take the floor for a sec if you want. One last data point, life expectancy going down 3 years in a row in this country. That's unheard of in a developed country, isn't it? I think
it's not unheard of.
Okay.
So it is certainly disturbing, not unheard of. We do know that a lot of the changes in life expectancy over the last 3 years happened due to, in part, the COVID-19 pandemic, particularly as it affected sort of the 75 and up crowd, but that itself, I think, did knock about 6 months to a year off of.
And let's add Lewis's point that was brilliant during the COVID days, which was it took us back to the dark old days of 2004.
Correct. So, you know, it does also help to look at these terms in absolute as well as, you know, analyzing are they just going up or going down. And so, you know, given that the average life expectancy in the U.S., I believe, is still about 76 years old, 77 years old, mm-hmm. that is comparable to most developed countries. One other piece, though, I'd like to make just on your question on are we headed for one of those 300-year civilizational unwindings? One statistic that is alarming is the average age a woman in the U.S. has their first child. I believe it is north of 28. Now, the only society that I'm aware of from a historical perspective before the year, say, 2000 or so, in which the average a woman at birth had a child at 28 was Europe in its recovery after the Black Death. That is alarming. However, it's not that we don't want to have kids anymore. As much as we think we're being propagandized, if you survey young women, they still say, as they have always said, that they want to actually have about a replacement rate number of children. It's just that our society and the workplace and all the expectations around that are so convoluted and poorly balanced. And I think that the incentives are such and the narratives are such that, that you know, women are told through sort of the new feminist story that they should behave like men. Like, we haven't actually thought about how do we solve the problems that are unique to women. We've just thought, let's make women act like 95th percentile men, like corporate CEOs, and that will make them happy. But another thing, though, as much as we've been talking about, is the U.S. headed towards this 300-year moment, I want to expand that to the rest of the globe, because as much as the U.S. is having trouble, you know, these notions of teen depression and anxiety, all of these social ills, these are not unique to the United States. And we ignore that at our peril. These are global phenomena. I said I was concerned about the birth rate here in the U.S. In China, by contrast, over the past 3 years, the birth rate has collapsed lower than it was for the Jews of Europe during the Holocaust. How's that for a statistic?
Irrelevant to me, because I'm thinking about where America is relative to where America could be, has been, and should be.
So I'm not
surprised that tyrannical nations have these problems or massively sexist.
This comes back to the notion that we are Stone Age creatures with medieval institutions and the technology of gods.
Yeah.
And that technology is only increasing over and over and over. And so I would expect us to be increasingly deranged as the 21st century rolls around and rolls along.
You may get it. You may get that expectation. You may achieve
it. The question that we have is how do we start to come to grips with things that we are doing? When we are changing how society works, we are changing the ways that we interact with society. We are adding whole new ecosystems on top of society faster than a single generation can grow up. And so it is faster than that we can even observe the effects that these have on ourselves. We are changing ourselves in real time as we adopt this technology.
It is effectively that we as human beings no longer are in a world in which humanity is the central core. It is systems that now runs the planet and runs our lives. And we are not very good at that as human beings. And it is making a level of misery for all of us to deal with.
Yes, but comparable technological leaps did not have that effect on America. Air travel, communications, publishing. Let me have you guys wind this up on the other side. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Lewis Hallman and Hugh Hallman have been my guests this hour. I think I want to do 3 hours on this and bring in other Hallmans, actually. This topic of inventiveness, entrepreneurship, technological advances, and philosophical regression, or whatever the opposite of regression is, acclivity, I suppose. I'd love to do 3 hours with you guys on it, but in the meantime, with everything we put on the
table. But we'll have to get Marcus to join us.
Yeah, I'd love that. It would be important. Maybe next week. Take the last couple minutes and sum up what you want to sum up with.
Sure. So, you know, we were point of us being Stone Age creatures with medieval institutions and access to godlike technology.
Yeah.
One area in particular that is changing very rapidly is there is a revolution in military affairs that is going on right now. And what is happening is the ability for a squad level or fire team level unit to deploy a weapon system that can target something out in the tens or hundreds of miles or kilometers, which was previously the range of something like a strategic missile system, a cruise missile, an artillery piece, something like that. And so we are changing. We are entering a world where your average infantryman with drones is going to have the ability to potentially to reach out and strike strategic infrastructure hundreds of miles away. We've never been in a world that looks anything like that. War, as we know it, is going to change fundamentally in response to this scenario, because what we're doing, in effect, is we are giving a private the strategic and military impetus of what was traditionally the role of a battlefield commander or general. And all of our command and control systems are going to have to accommodate this. Our diplomatic systems are going to have to accommodate this. What happens if Joe Schmo, you know, patrolling Fallujah, launches his drone and is able to target Tehran? Does that cause an international incident? How do we respond to that? What is the range that we then have to put on these new systems? And more importantly, if these are becoming more and more common and are then threatening the traditional high capital investment systems that we've already invested in that are legacy systems, how does the proliferation of these new systems and technologies and methods of war then threaten to overturn our position as something of a dreadnought problem?
And this is all about the technology and the fact that we now have teenagers with joysticks who we watched 30 years ago using them to control things on televisions, now controlling the world. That's the universe in which we're entering, and we have failed to teach them about the philosophical groundings to help them make good decisions, mm-hmm. not just decisions.
Nicely done.
And the right is not advocating for a cogent, sensible America. If we can do that, if we can get out in front of it, then maybe we can put some order. But right now, the only ones that are the madmen making these munitions and the doughy-eyed people running them.
Until tomorrow, God bless you all. I'm Seth Leibson, and
class dismissed.